Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The World Health Organization is now saying that the swine flu outbreak is moving closer to a Phase 5 pandemic out of six possible phases, Level 5 indicating widespread human-to-human transmission. In the U.S., the first death, that of a Mexican toddler visiting Brownsville, Texas for medical care, has been confirmed, along with 91 cases in 10 states, double the number of states from yesterday. Let's get the latest from Los Angeles Times science and medical writer Tom Mao in Los Angeles. Tom, what are officials saying today?
Well, that it's continuing to spread, and they don't see any evidence of it slowing down at this point.
And what are they suggesting? Beyond increasing surveillance at the border, what else are health and government officials doing?
Well, they're distributing more supplies of antiviral drugs to the states and cities so that they can give the drug to contacts in an effort to prevent transmission. They are working to try to grow the virus to make a vaccine, but that's going to take months. They're just being as aggressive as possible in trying to control this.
There were five states with confirmed cases yesterday. Which states have been added to the list today?
Arizona, Massachusetts, Michigan, and Nevada.
And what are officials saying about a vaccine? We know you've been hearing that it takes months to come up with the right one. Is that still the case?
Yes, the first step is growing what they call a seed stock of the virus. That means just getting it to grow in eggs so that they can distribute it to the manufacturers. And it turns out that the virus is growing a little slower in eggs than normal flu viruses do. So that's slowing down the process. But even so, it's still going to take 4 to 6 months to do a virus. To do a vaccine. There's just no way around that.
And just remind us, we want to point out that thousands of people, the vulnerable, the elderly, die every year from flu. We have so few cases here, one tragic death, but just one. So again, what is all the concern?
Well, the concern is that the virus might undergo another mutation that would lead to more severe infections like has occurred in Mexico. And if that's the case, then we might see more deaths than we're seeing now. So far, there's no evidence to suggest that's happening anywhere but in Mexico, and it's not clear why the cases have been more severe there.
Well, yeah, and tell us more about that, because we spoke to epidemiologists yesterday who were saying that's got to be the key question. Why is it so many people, over 100 now, have died in Mexico? One death, but it was a Mexican child traveling from Mexico, already ill, it would seem. So why is there so much more severity in Mexico?
Well, nobody really knows. You have to keep in mind that it is flu season now, and there are a lot of deaths from flu. Out of that 160 or so deaths in Mexico, only 26 of them have been confirmed to be this new swine virus. So it may well be that the majority of those are just caused by regular influenza. And the good news there is that the influenza season is almost over. So, we can kind of hope that the epidemic will peter out for now, at least.
Well, and Mexican officials are already saying in Mexico City, for instance, that once it does, they hope to relax some of the restrictions there. But then we have this announcement from the World Health Organization, WHO, saying that the outbreak is inching closer to a Phase 5 pandemic. So we're getting mixed messages. Do you have an understanding of why?
Well, we're talking about two different situations, really. In Mexico, they're saying that the number of new cases is slowing down, which might allow them to ease some of the restrictions. What WHO is talking about is the fact that we're seeing cases of person-to-person transmission. In other words, somebody traveled to Mexico, caught the virus, came back, gave it to somebody else that they contacted in their home country. And that's the particular concern here. That means that this virus can spread from human to human. Now, it may be that it'll peter out anyway, but that's why they're on such a high stage of alert.
Well, and then we remind ourselves, in 1918, isn't it true that flu, what became a flu pandemic, was an epidemic that petered out and then came back?
Yeah, it was very mild in the spring during the spring flu season. Then it disappeared for a while, and then when the flu season came back in the fall, it turned very severe, and people are afraid that can happen here.
Tom Mao, science and medical writer for the Los Angeles Times, speaking to us from Los Angeles. Tom, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And we want to take just a couple minutes now to follow up on an issue we raised yesterday having to do with schools and swine flu. Here's President Obama today on the topic.
Schools with confirmed or suspected cases of H1N1 should strongly consider temporarily closing so that we can be as safe as possible.
Well, of course, schools already are closing. Yesterday, we spoke with the school nurse who first noticed this outbreak in Queens, New York. That school remains closed. And we spoke also with Amy Garcia, executive director of the National Association of School Nurses, who was concerned that the emergency response to swine flu could possibly be slowed down by a federal requirement that schools get written permission from parents before information about kids' health is released. Now, Amy joined 1,000 nurses on a conference call with federal officials trying to get more guidance on that issue. And at least one of our listeners, Dr. Dorothy Novick, a pediatrician in Philadelphia, was surprised to learn that schools have separate privacy restrictions. They operate under the FERPA regulation. The rest of us are covered by HIPAA. But Dr. Novick also said she thought there had to be exceptions to privacy requirements for schools, even though they are under FERPA, during emergencies. Well, it turns out she's right. Martha Berggren is director of research with the National Association of School Nurses. Martha, what does the Department of Education tell you now about what schools should do?
Well, we had the specific question about whether or not this episode early on constituted an emergency, and at what level of alert would school nurses and school officials be allowed to share information with the public health department without written authorization.
And we should say that one of the problems is that you often can't get that written authorization. Parents work, you can't get in touch with them. Amy said that a lot of nurses work with parents who don't speak English. So you were looking for a way to do this more quickly.
We felt that being able to share that child's identification with the health department would speed up the process.
Right.
So yesterday I put a call into the Department of Education Office of Family Compliance, which is responsible for enforcing FERPA, and they assured us that during this event, the swine flu alert, that we could use the technical guidance that was given out following the Virginia Tech tragedy that will allow us to release the names of students to public health officials during this alert. And if you feel that a child's health is endangering them or the community, then you can share that information with your public health officials.
Oh, so you don't have to have sort of the government acknowledging that there's a threat, an alert. If you feel that there's an immediate emergency and the child's health or the health of other children is threatened, you can release their name.
You would need to make that case, yes.
Mm-hmm.
They were much more explicit about that following the Virginia Tech. Our questions yesterday at the beginning of this event were, you know, a nurse in a state where there have not been any cases and she has a child with symptoms, can they release that individual child's name? And we were told yes.
And yet it sounds like you're telling us that after the Virginia Tech shootings, if there's any thought of an emergency, whether it's swine flu or a child who may be emotionally upset, you schools have the right to forward that name to authorities?
That's correct.
Martha Berggren, Director of Research with the National Association of School Nurses. Martha, thank you so much.
Well, thank you for your interest.
Oh, of course, Martha also wants us to point out that they will also continue to try to contact the parents as they alert officials. Well, 3 confirmed cases and 10 suspected cases of swine flu in teenagers have been reported in the neighboring towns of Cibolo and Schertz in southern Texas. Steve Liberato is a city councilman in the town of Cibolo. He's also a registered nurse and an 18-year veteran of the town's volunteer fire department. Steve, first, we understand all 14 campuses of your area's school district have been closed since last Friday?
That's correct, and they're going to remain closed through this week.
Okay, and because these are 3 high school students who have been confirmed to have the virus, any word, first of all, on how they might have contracted it?
No, the epidemiology studies are still going on. They haven't really found out why. 2 of the students we know for sure have not been out of country. The 3rd one they're not sure about.
But you're on the border with Mexicans, and we understand that Easter season, many cross the border to shop.
Yeah, they come to shop and be with their families at church services on Easter, so we get quite a bit of influx of visitors from Mexico.
Okay, so there's cross-pollination there. Well, what else is being done in the town, given that you have 3 confirmed cases and perhaps a fear of more? What's happening?
We closed all of our city parks last week. We have asked the homeowners associations to close all their parks, which they have. Daycare and nurseries are closed.
We understand you mentioned many Mexicans came to go to church with their family Easter. Church services have been canceled?
Some of the local churches did cancel this most recent Sunday's church services on a voluntary basis.
And that's a big deal, I understand, in that area.
It is.
Well, and also tell us some other things being done, just, you know, as little precautions we might not think of. I mean, you know, how are people paying their bills at City Hall?
Presently, we're giving them envelopes and asking them to drop their payment outside. We're trying to limit the contact in City Hall. We have, for this week, suspended issuing building permits, license of animals, you know, pet permits has been suspended for this week.
And we talked yesterday in the program with a school nurse about how teenagers in particular in high schools are sort of petri dishes because teenagers can wash their hands, you know, but they're still kissing each other. I mean, you know, these are teens. So what special precautions are being taken for teens other than closing the schools?
We're just trying to reinforce the guidance that's been going on for years. You know, avoid contact, wash hands frequently, cover your mouth and nose while coughing, try to limit the number of people in groups. Unfortunately, many of them, you know, they're teenagers and they're out congregating with their friends, and so that's a little hard to control. The parents have done a pretty good job of keeping them out of the parks and off the streets, but I think as this goes on and cabin fever sets in, we'll have a little bit more problems.
Well, we understand that, you know, some teens have to work and some stores are telling them, you know, don't come in.
That's true. In our largest grocery store, they had basically given the children a week off with pay.
And you're a firefighter as well as a city councilman, so, and a registered nurse. Do people call with suspected cases, and how, if so, how do you respond?
The answer, yes, they do call. We try to maintain a hands-off approach, try to stay 7-8 feet away from the patient until we can get some more of their history. And if it's not a respiratory distress, we recommend they contact their doctor. Don't go to the hospital. Don't go to the doctor's office without first contacting them. The cases we have seen have been relatively mild. It appears at this point within a person to be self-limiting.
I was going to ask you that. We have this report of a fatality of a toddler today, but
right.
We're hearing that in general, the cases are much milder. How are the kids in town doing?
They're doing great. The first two confirmed are fully recovered. The third one that was recently confirmed, he's doing great.
Steve Liberato, city councilman in Cibolo, Texas. Steve, thanks so much for speaking with us.
You're very welcome.
And, of course, we'll continue to follow this story for you. But as you've probably heard, this week marks 100 days of the Obama administration. The flu outbreak is one major challenge. But what about that plane flying low over New York City? Up next, a snapshot of the Obama administration. From auto workers to a country store owner, we'll hear what average Americans have to say about President Obama's first 100 days. And later, they're calling it Muslim MTV, but also Mormon books for young adults. Back in a minute, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back to Here and Now. The New York Post calls it Scare Force One. It's the story of a backup Air Force One that did a low flyover New York City for a publicity photo. President Obama says he's furious. He's ordered an investigation. In a minute, we're going to have a round robin of opinions on Obama's first 100 days. But first, Rick Klein of ABC News political blog, The Note. Rick, the flyover frightened New Yorkers who ran from their offices. But Homeland Security Chief Janet Napolitano didn't seem to know anything about it. Does this signal a lack of communication?
Yeah, and there was such secrecy surrounding it that even the Obama White House didn't know about it till after it happened. And obviously it scared New Yorkers, and I think from President Obama's perspective, it's an embarrassment, and, right. And they've acknowledged as much that they didn't even know this was happening with their own airplane.
Well, and what does that say? You know, people are concerned about communication post 9/11. How could these huge planes be flying around Manhattan and Homeland Security not know?
it speaks to the huge bureaucracy that's out there. Certain individuals, even in New York City government, knew about it, but they weren't all talking to each other.
Is there a sense that somebody should be fired, that Obama needs to make a stronger statement?
That's very much a possibility. The head of the White House Office of Military Affairs has taken responsibility for this. There's an internal inquiry going on at the White House. This could easily end with someone losing his or her job.
Well, and we were also wondering the same thing the New York Daily News asked. What about Photoshop? Why do you need to fly a plane around? They've even set up a website so their readers can create their own photos with Air Force One in the background.
And there was nothing wrong with the original picture, which had Air Force One in front of Mount Rushmore. People like that. More than $300,000 was spent on this, and this is the time that President Obama has said he wants to cut $100 million from the budget. Well, you could have, you know, you start getting there with pockets of money like this.
Okay, so a misstep in the last few of the 100 days. Rick Klein of ABC News political blog The Note, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Okay, let's get some public opinion on Obama's 100 days. 57-year-old Doug Hanscom of Dundalk, Maryland, worked for GM for 32 years. He recently took a buyout to retire early. Doug, you said overall you're happy, but you obviously have some concerns about what will happen with the auto industry.
I watch the news and follow what's going on every day, and it has got me very concerned. GM gave me an incentive to retire, and then they've been doing it like for the last 4 years, giving auto workers incentives to retire. And it's almost as if they're like herding everybody into this little corral, and then they're going to cut their legs off once they get them all together, and then they walk away free and clear.
Whoa, what an image. Well, and what are your biggest concerns? How do you worry that it might play out?
There's the concern of my pension, especially. Currently, my pension stands at about $39,000. And if the government takes it over, I'll probably be cut down to $24,000.
What do you say to someone who says, you know, $39,000 a year, you're retired, that's good enough?
Well, it is a fairly decent pension. I got to concede that. But I earned it. I mean, I put in a hard 32 years on that assembly line. My body feels it.
Well, what can President Obama do for you?
The GM pension fund is currently 85% funded, from what I understand. I would like to see, like, maybe the government not allow GM to dump that pension fund, to, like, put it into a separate fund and maybe add to it what money they would have given to GM.
Well, and, you know, a lot of the bailout money on Wall Street went into the pockets of executives in bonuses and salaries. It sounds like you're saying, too, put some of that bailout money in my pension fund.
Yeah, absolutely. These guys don't deserve it. The same people that drove the economy into the tank are walking away with bonuses. I mean, there's something wrong with that picture.
Doug Hanscom of Dundalk, Maryland, a retired GM auto worker. Doug, thanks so much.
All right, thank you.
Let's go now to Canterbury, New Hampshire. And Tony Halla, the manager of the Canterbury Country Store, you might remember. We visited her during election season. She was not a fan of Barack Obama then. I suspect she's not now. Tony, am I right?
I can be bought.
Ah.
You know what he did right? He told the military to go ahead, and they took care of the Captain Phillips situation. I'm ambivalent, because as much as I pride myself on being hidebound and the old reflexive Republican, I have to say the man is trying very hard. He's personable. He's photogenic. He's planting a garden. I view some of this with a jaundiced eye, but for the most part, I applaud what he's trying to do. I also worry terribly about his lack of experience and some of his advisors. There seem to be an awful lot of cabinet people who don't pay taxes.
Well, and let's touch on another topic, because you and be frank, because you're always so very frank with us, which
we
appreciate, and that's race. You said you like your comfort zone. You're comfortable with what you know, and that included...
Old white guys.
There you go. So has Barack Obama made you a little more comfortable about a leader who doesn't look like old white guys?
Oh, I hope not. No.
Here you go.
Then what would my shtick be?
Well,
I have probably a reaction to them as people, really, rather than black people. Everybody is very happy with the fact that they seem so accessible, and they get a Portuguese water dog and all this stuff, and that's all well and good. I still wouldn't vote for him now for a lot of reasons.
Let's talk about something like the economy. Here you are, a small business owner. How do you feel Obama has handled that?
I'm disgusted with Bush for starting it and Obama for keeping it. We are rewarding bad behavior. Where's my stimulus? Where is my reward?
That's Tony Halla, a manager of the Canterbury Country Store in Canterbury, New Hampshire. As always, thanks so much for speaking with us.
See you next time.
And again, our snapshot continues. Ryan Bowen joins us. Ryan, you rode your bicycle more than 3,000 miles from your home in Los Angeles to Washington, D.C. for Obama's inauguration. Looking back, has he lived up to your hopes?
I say that he has.
Why? What do you like?
The foreign travel. A couple of weeks ago, we see him in Venezuela with Chavez, and I don't think I would have ever seen a picture with Bush and them shaking hands. You know, I think that we're actually reaching out to a more dialogical fashion of interacting with the world.
So you'd like more dialogue, but even Obama backers have criticism that he said there wouldn't be earmarks in the stimulus package, and there are. He said he doesn't want investigations into harsh interrogation techniques during the Bush administration, even though he's since decided he won't stand in the way of possible investigations of the lawyers who backed those techniques. Some supporters are disappointed.
You know, that is definitely a concern of mine, is the failure to go ahead and attack some of the poor policies that we've had in the past.
But overall, Ryan, you are still a big booster of Barack Obama.
I think he's the best chance that we got right now. I think his own calm and tranquility in the midst of the storms that are going around is the most positive thing that I believe we have.
Ryan Bowen, a bike rider and still backer of Barack Obama. Ryan, thanks.
Thank you.
And by the way, tomorrow on Here and Now, New York Times columnist Tom Friedman on what Obama needs to do to green the country. That's tomorrow. Still ahead today, you say you want more good news? We've got more good news for you from the Good News Network after the real news Here and Now. The standoff in Sri Lanka continues. Tens of thousands of civilians are trapped between the Tamil Tiger rebel fighters and the ethnic Sinhalese government troops, the government accusing the Tamil Tigers of holding the civilians as human shields, the Tamil Tigers accusing the government of refusing to accept their ceasefire offer to let the civilians escape. Meanwhile, British and French foreign ministers arrived in Sri Lanka today and urged the government to accept the rebel ceasefire offer, then toured some of the displacement camps that are struggling to accommodate about 150,000 civilians that have been able to flee the war zone, a massive humanitarian crisis. Lisbeth List of Doctors Without Borders is in the town of Avunya, about 50 miles from the fighting. Camps have been set up near a state-run hospital. Lisbeth, start with the hospital. Are people sick or wounded?
These are wounded. They are injured by war wounds. So we see landmine injuries, we see blast injuries, we see gunshot injuries.
What are they telling you, if you've had a chance to talk, about what they saw in the war zone?
The first thing people talk about, really, when they arrive, whether it's to the hospital or to a camp, is they want information about family members who have either been left behind, that they've lost track of, or family members that were taken when they were separated. For instance, one man was really asking me about his wife, who was taken to the hospital, and he's in a camp, and he has no information if she's okay, she's pregnant, you know, what's happened to the baby. So most people are seeking information about their loved ones. But they also talk about what they saw, and nearly every person that I've spoken with has seen either someone that's dead or has been killed, even children. So kind of a shocked look comes with them, and we have about 150,000 displaced people here now. So, you know, trying to provide the water, the sanitation, the shelter, the food, and the medical care has been a real challenge. And, I mean, I have to say that the Ministry of Health has put plans in place. They are tending to the people in the camps who may not have been sick enough or ill enough to go to the hospital. So, you know, there are doctors in the camps to see these people, but the numbers are overwhelming.
Well, there is concern that these transition camps will turn into internment camps. Tell us more about the situation there.
Well, most of the camps that are established are built as transit camps. So the shelter, the water, the sanitation facilities, it's temporary. It's to last for 3 months maximum. But, you know, it's possible that these people will stay there longer than that. I mean, at the moment, we're really just trying to attend the immediate needs. People arriving are completely exhausted. They're dehydrated. I am seeing more and more malnutrition amongst children and elderly people. In the camps, they may be 1 or 2 kilometers in length, you know, each direction. So, I mean, they're quite large camps, but they're living in, you know, basic temporary shelters made of plastic sheeting or a tent. The water is brought in. It's still kind of at the minimum standard and still needs to be improved, but people are receiving at least 5 liters of drinking water a day, but, you know, that's minimum. and they spend the day wondering what's next, what's going to happen, and worrying about their other family members.
You mentioned the elderly. I remember reading a report earlier this week that there aren't that many elderly who are arriving, and the feeling is that they had to have died along the trek because it's just too much.
I am very surprised when I see elderly. I am sure that plenty did die along the way because it was a difficult move, but there are elderly here. I had an elderly man telling me, look, I can't see well, I can't hear well. He could, you know, hardly move very well. And he got separated from his daughter, and she was the only one taking care of him. So he said, you know, how am I going to take care of myself here? I need to find her. So it's very heartbreaking, but, I mean, they are somehow managing to escape and make the journey.
Lisbeth List, she's medical coordinator for Doctors Without Borders in Vavunya, Sri Lanka, where about 150,000 people have fled the fighting between government forces and the rebel Tamil Tigers. Lisbeth, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much.
Okay, don't forget, before we go today, Mormon Authors for Young Adults, Here and Now. America has long had Christian rock, more recently Christian rap. Well, Egypt now has Four Shabab. It means four youth in Arabic. It's the name of a new TV channel that showcases modern Islamic music and videos, including hip-hop and rap. It's being called Muslim MTV, and the BBC's Rebecca Fordham went to Four Shabab's offices in Cairo for this report.
Give me the countdown loudly, please. Ashara. Faster, please. Go.
In a basic rented studio in Cairo, Four Shabab is getting ready to go on air. The entire production staff are male, as is the presenter. Like MTV, they play a selection of videos, have phone-ins and offer prizes. But it all has a Muslim content. Ahmed Abu Haber, the executive director, told me why he'd chosen music videos to deliver an Islamic message.
The young people, they're not listening. And they listen to the music, they listen to songs, they listen to drama. I believe in Islam as a lifestyle, and this is actually the message that I'm delivering. Through art, I can put this image, I can put this life in front of the people in the screen. I don't want long speeches. I just need picture the people can see.
Ahmed Abu Haber thinks young Muslims are not getting Islam's message by watching Western contemporary music, and so is creating an alternative. I went to see some young Muslim girls who would prefer not to watch Western music, but they think that most contemporary Arab music is just derivative of what can be seen on MTV.
I think there will be an audience. Not a very broad one, but there will be.
Could you explain to me what you'd want to see?
I think I'd like to see things like this. People who look like us in the videos, you know? Like, mainly religious music videos, they're like a woman with a hijab kneeling and praying, and you know, there's this cliche image. And you can't relate to something like this. There need to be people who look like us.
The Islamic songs that we have these days are beneficial somehow for the spiritual level, but on daily basis, yeah, you can't hear them every day. Sometimes you just need to listen to something that's, you're not going to focus in it, just something that's keeping on the background.
The girls and I looked up the Four Shabab channel on the web.
They're going to get a song.
Here it is.
No, it's so messed up.
The content of the songs is religious, but I don't see quality music.
What did you think of it?
I don't know, I didn't see it that attractive. These people, I have never heard of them. I don't know them, and they don't offer, I think, something that is unique and different.
And have you been?
I don't see quality music. I see mainstream music and rephrased into a religious context.
Okay, so not terribly impressed?
No.
Blessed is your face, blessed is your name.
Some Muslim singers have struck a chord with the girls. For example, the very popular Sami Yusuf has combined Islamic issues whilst keeping his lyrics relevant and his look fresh.
My soul want to fly, my beloved.
yes, some spiritual songs, and at the same time you can find something that's related to like social relationships between people. So I think that's the kind of music that some people would like. I like him, by the way, but because he's different, and it's in English, and it's like sometimes modern type of songs.
I saw in this kind of music, I saw like a glimpse of what I would want to see, but not so much it.
But there is concern. Four Shabab may claim to be the first Muslim MTV, but there is already a lot of religious programming, and if you flick through the channels, much of it comes from the Gulf. Dr. Saeed Sadek, Professor of Sociology at the American University of Cairo.
I'm not happy when I see this heavy dosage of religious media in the Arab world. The Arab world doesn't need religious channels or religious music channels. What we need is discovery channels. We need history channels. We need scientific teaching channels. This is what we need. All this stuff, again, is contributing to the distortion of the Arab identity.
Some may have concerns about the channel's effect on society, but others criticize the very idea of using hip-hop and rap music, which grew out of underground movements, to deliver a mainstream Islamic message. Akram Farag, CEO of Emerging World Entertainment.
The religious undertone is really massive, so what am I promoting? More of that? And is music the right frontier? I'm using the wrong vehicle to promote something which is, in a way, that used to be the voice of opposition for something which is really, if I say, well, the religion is the opium of the masses, and it's really opium of the masses when it comes to the Middle East.
But Four Shabab's Ahmed Abu Haber is convinced with time people will be won over.
What I'm trying to do is trying to apply my ideas, trying to present very good material, very nice lyrics, a very fast tempo, amazing graphics. So the people would be astonished what damage they're seeing. Just need time.
As I left the studio, Ahmed Abu Haber oozed confidence, but it's not a proven success yet. Very few people have heard of it. It's perhaps a shame, as the young people in Cairo seem to have an appetite for a TV channel that combines their religious beliefs with their love of music.
The BBC's Rebecca Fordham reporting from Cairo. Well, we try to cover culture for you as well as the news, because often the news is, let's face it, a downer. Recently, listener Michael Jones wrote after a particularly tough news program, "I hope you're not normally this melancholic. It seems like every topic was designed to make me feel bad. Please, look outside. Find some sunshine." Well, we have. Here are recent headlines. Food packaging giants plan massive giveaways. Damaged Great Barrier Reef makes spectacular recovery. Miracle Baby survives cold night in the woods. They are all featured on the Good News Network. Jerry Corbley operates the website from her home in Virginia and joins us now. Jerry, welcome.
Hey, Robin, it's good to talk to you.
Well, we know a lot of news agencies have started adding some good news. Brian Williams of NBC News asked for some good news items, and now he delivers a couple at the end of his newscast. And the Christian Science Monitor has a section for good news. But you are all good news. Why did you create this site?
Back in the 90s, when murder rates were plummeting, the broadcasting of them went up 700%. So as I began to see that the news was really focusing on all this negative stuff, which is really a small minority of what's going on in the world, and I come from a news background. I used to work in TV news.
I understand you were a CNN camera operator.
Yes, I was. And I talked to my colleagues about, hey, there should be a good news show, and they said, good news doesn't sell. And I didn't believe them because I saw Oprah was number one, and I didn't see why it couldn't carry over into the news business.
Well, and you're on to something. The Los Angeles Times now has a Twitter feed devoted to good news, but there is still plenty of bad news.
There is plenty of bad news.
You know, we have the two ongoing wars, we have the economy. So is this a little bit rose-colored glasses?
People are trying to get a balance in life. It's like a vitamin for news. You know, it's vitamin G for good news. I mean, you just need it sometimes. The traffic is way up since the recession. People are signing up and paying.
Well, here are some of your good news stories. There's a doctor in Illinois who's giving free treatment to patients who've lost their jobs. Two anonymous women in Michigan making care packages for homeless people. But give us a bigger good news story.
Well, Sweden approves same-sex marriage legislation, which is nice for Sweden, and I'm sure the people there mostly agree.
Oh, you know, that's interesting. Someone's good news might be someone else's, you know, really bad headline, and that's one.
It is a little tricky, editorial-wise, choosing the good news. There's no question about it.
That's Jerry Weiss-Corbley. She operates the Good News Network from her home in Virginia. Good News 24/7. Jerry, thanks so much for talking to us about it.
My pleasure.
And we'll continue to bring you all the news, no matter what you call it, here and now. Back in a minute. Here and now.
Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org.
Welcome back. Here's a scene a few of you will recognize.
I know what you are.
Say it. Out loud. Say it.
Vampire.
It was when watching the wildly popular film Twilight that a realization struck us. The film and the book that it was based on was a wonderful example of delayed gratification because a lot could go wrong when you kiss a vampire. It worked as a metaphor for abstaining from sex to avoid the many complications. Another theme in the book series, one can spend eternal life with your family because vampires live forever. So it didn't surprise us to learn that the author, Stephanie Meyer, is a practicing Mormon who studied at Brigham Young University. In fact, as a recent article in the Boston Globe pointed out, the young adult and fantasy fiction genres boast quite a few authors who are members of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, or LDS. Enough that Chris Crow, a professor of English at Brigham Young University, has co-edited a book about them. It's called How I Came to Write, LDS Authors for Young Adults, and he joins us in the studio. Welcome.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
So who knew? You know, Stephanie Meyer, the best known, but then there's Shannon Hale, who wrote the Newbery Honor book, The Princess Academy, award-winning science fiction author Orson Scott Card. Why do you think it is that Mormons seem to be so compatible with young adult literature?
Part of it, I think, has to do with something that happened at BYU in 1962, where our English department started a class in young adult literature, and it was about 5 years ahead of the curve. From that class group came out some writers. I think there's something about Mormon culture that's compatible with young adult books. Young adult books, the audience is someone, usually a teenager, and the Mormon church values youth. The church itself is still, it may be in some ways, adolescent, especially compared to the Catholic church. And so the traditional young adult novel is really a coming-of-age novel. And since we care about young people, we care about how they come of age.
We were wondering if a part of it is how Mormons see children, because they have many of them, you know, large Mormon families. But author Orson Scott Card said that he was, you know, taught to take himself seriously as a child, that there are very young figures in the Mormon liturgy.
Yeah, the founder of our faith, Joseph Smith, was a 14-year-old boy when he first had his vision and proclaimed that despite a lot of antagonism. And so, yeah, the idea that an adolescent matters is one that goes right to the very beginnings of our church
right.
In the 19th century.
He writes beautifully, by the way, in your book. He learned that children can change the world. Their actions reverberate. The earth trembles with their footfalls, even if adults can't see them. He said it was a secret he learned as a child, and he didn't forget it, that, you know, somebody else might not see it, but kids know. And that's at the core of young adult literature, isn't it?
It is. And one of the old standards in writing a young adult novel is first you have to kill off the parents. But it's not exactly kill them off, but they need to be off stage so the adolescents can act freely and a real sense of independence. And I would guess that most teenagers, whether they're Mormon or not, feel like they don't have enough independence. But I think they imagine that if they did, they could do wonderful things. They could change the world. That kind of youthful optimism is something that all adolescents have.
Well, you've also said another thing that makes young adult fantasy conducive to Mormon authors is that it has a very strong sense of right and wrong. For example, the vampire family at the center of the Twilight books are vegetarian. They don't kill people. They, unfortunately, kill animals. They're very protective of humans. They have a very strict moral code. It would have to be, it would think, in order for that series to work at all.
Well, for it to work for Stephanie, I think, if she wants to write a vampire story that works with her boundaries, I think it had to be the kind of story that she wrote. So you have nuclear families that are generally functioning pretty well, who look out for one another. You have strict moral codes that they're willing to abide by, even though it's difficult. They're sometimes persecuted because of their differences or because of their stands. So I think those are things that Stephanie learned as a person, but certainly learned as a Latter-day Saint.
Well, and then what about the fantastical element? Now, I want to rush to say many religions have one, and I don't use the word fantastic in the pejorative. There's, you know, the burning bush, the resurrection.
Right.
You know, just the idea of heaven and hell. This is, you know, fantastic thinking. And in the LDS faith, we've spoken to scholars here on the program, the belief that families can reunite in the flesh after death, perhaps, you know, in a certain progression on their own planets. Joseph Smith, as you said, the founder of the faith, needed a seer stone, S-E-E-R, to read the Book of Mormon. Is there something in the faith and its affinity for the fantastical that makes these writers even more, you know, primed to write for young adults or science fiction?
That seems like a logical connection, especially given that not just Stephanie, but some of the newer fantasy writers, Brandon Sanderson is going to, he's a graduate of our MA program, is going to finish the Wheel of Time series. Brandon Mull has had this series, Fable Haven, that's been a New York Times bestseller. So some of our newest writers are being most successful in fantasy, and I think part of it must go back to what you're describing, that in our faith, these things that are otherworldly have happened. A vision of God, well, we believe that. I believe that. So maybe it is that for some Mormons, that willing suspension of disbelief, that willing to embrace that there is another possibility, another way that things can happen, certainly feeds this propensity to write fantasy and to read fantasy. I think also with fantasy, the boundaries maybe are a little tighter in the sense that if you're on a hero's quest, you're not on a quest to go rape someone or to, you know, go get drunk or do something else. You're on it. You're on this focused mission to accomplish something grand. And that means that the kinds of things that might offend Mormon readers are less likely to be central to a fantasy novel than it would be in a contemporary realistic novel.
Yeah. Just one last question. Here you are, a professor of English at Brigham Young University. Is there something that you teach students about being a Mormon and writing for young adults? Is there anything that jumps out that would be markedly different from a young adult writing class anywhere else?
I think the basics would be the same if I were teaching anywhere. The difference in our class is sometimes we talk about the spiritual components of being a writer. What kind of daily personal habits can I have that help me get words on the page?
Yeah, because you can't go smoke and drink.
Right, right. So you can't be Faulkner.
That's right. So
you know, what are some things that are unique to our campus at BYU, for example? I encourage them that if you're doing something that's creative and you need inspiration, well, then you probably should be praying every single day that you can have inspiration to help you through this kind of complicated process of writing a novel.
Yeah. That's Chris Crow, professor of English at Brigham Young University, speaking about the preponderance of Mormon writers of young adult literature. Professor Crow, thanks so much for talking to us.
My pleasure to be here. Thank you.
We leave you with more music from the film Twilight. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.